Hello, this is Anja Steinbohr from Philosophy Now magazine, bringing you today's Philosophy Now radio. Our topic today is feminist philosophy. What is it? What should it be? What can it do? Joining me on the show are four women who have extensive experience and strong views on these matters. They are Anne Brisby, who co-organizes the Philosophy Forum, Feminism Philosophy Forum of the London-based philosophy group Philosophy for All; Vicky Bell, who is Professor of Sociology at Goldsmiths College; Mina Danda, who is reader in philosophy at the University of Wolverhampton; and Terry Murray, who has worked as an independent documentary maker. She's a philosopher and theologian and currently teaches sixth form philosophy. Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining me.
Hi.
Okay, well, here's a general warm-up question for you, but one which is also already philosophical, I think. And we should just start off by asking, well, what is feminism? Who would like to start us off?
Well, if you were to just look up a dictionary definition of feminism, it would say something like a doctrine that advocates equality for women. But I think what's also interesting is all the secondary connotations and associations that people have with feminism, many of them quite negative. And it's always assumed that feminists have to be women, which they don't.
Ah, thank you, Terry. Okay, Vicky.
Yeah, I think that feminism is about a commitment, actually. It's a kind of making a judgment and making a commitment to pass something on. I think one of the things I wanted to talk about today was the importance of passing on the history of feminism through our teaching and in other ways.
Yes, this is interesting, and perhaps we can talk a little bit more about what feminism is today, because it does have this 1970s ring to a lot of people. A lot of people, when they hear feminists, well, they sort of think of the 70s, and is it really still relevant today, Mina?
For me, feminism isn't a singular, first of all. By now, we would talk about feminisms, which is quite a mouthful, but I think that we have to recognize that there are many different ways in which we can challenge the subordination of women. And as philosophers, we are interested in understanding what is presupposed in launching an opposition to women's subordination. Does it involve a political or ethical commitment? How far does that commitment reach? Can I be effectively a feminist philosopher if I only ever give lectures of philosophy, feminist philosophy in the classroom, and do nothing in my life outside? Or does being a feminist philosopher also involve something like a notion of an activist intellectual who will, after having done the lecture on feminism in the class, go outside and do something to make a difference to the lives of women? For me, I would say it is the latter. I do hold an ideal of an activist intellectual, and I believe that to truly be a feminist philosopher, you have to let your values show through the way you actually live your life.
Yes, and I think that's a really interesting question. To what degree is this necessary, if you're a feminist theorist, to also be an activist? Is there a necessary connection between feminist theory, feminist activism, and what do you think?
Well, I think there is, because as feminists, we want to see a change in the way that society is organised. And that isn't going to just come about by wishing it so. It's going to involve action, and and we will certainly need to discuss with people of our acquaintance to raise their consciousness and so forth, as well as the activism that Mina was talking about.
Yes. Yes, Vicky.
I think it's important, though, not to make too stark a distinction between, some idea of, say, the university and the realm of activism, because I think these days it's much more fluid than that suggests.
Yes, but feminist theory is not easily accessible to everybody, though, is it? I mean, some of it is very difficult, some of it is highly philosophical, and so I suppose there's a spectrum, wouldn't you say?
First, Vicky, I do think that the two are combined, and that's why I said activist intellectual. I would have reservations about taking on board someone who was purely an intellectual. I do think from our knowledge that we have of a whole number of women who have gained notoriety in various academic and non-academic spheres, that they have shown their commitment outside the academia as well. So I speak from maybe a comfortable position here. But I would want to say that there are specifically perhaps academic questions about feminist philosophy as well. So some feminists have devoted a lot of time and a lot of energy to try and show the ways in which feminist women philosophers of the past have not been fully appreciated. And they've spent a lot of time in bringing their works into the public domain. And that, I think, could be just a work of scholarship, which we must appreciate and acknowledge and accept. But then beyond that, then there are other ways in which women philosophers have tried to make us appreciate the contribution of women, in that male philosophers have often unacknowledged, without acknowledging, appropriated the work of women philosophers. So it's there in their writings, but it's not been fully acknowledged. That's another interesting kind of detective work that some women philosophers do, point out the names and the ideas that are hidden in the work of the philosophers that we commonly read in history textbooks. I think that's quite an interesting way of introducing feminist philosophy to people who may not associate a given idea with a woman, when in fact that's where the idea came from.
And we'll come more to feminist philosophy and its particular contents as well. But perhaps to return to this question of what is feminism, and perhaps also who is a feminist. So Terry tells us, you know, feminists don't have to be women. What is involved in being a feminist? Is there necessarily a particular agenda? So Susan Faludi, in her fantastic book, The Backlash, says that there is, here I quote, feminism's agenda is basic. It asks that women not be forced to choose between public justice and private happiness. It asks that women be free to define themselves instead of having their identity defined for them, time and again, by their culture and their men. What do you think? Is this not perhaps asking a little too much? You know, who is really completely free to define themselves? Also, wouldn't you perhaps say that feminism could just simply be an interest in women's lives and the perspective of women without a particular agenda, political agenda, or is feminism always political? And what do you think?
Well, I think that feminism always has a political agenda, or it's empty. We disagree on what is just or unjust, and your point about our being free to decide is well taken, but the view is really related to the ancient view of women as functional. Right. Whereas men could be individuals.
Yes.
We're really sort of seeing, wanting everyone to be seen as an individual, but also having a requirement to be involved with social matters like care work.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, I think it's a deeply philosophical question, isn't it? When do you know that you're free, and being free to decide, you know, presupposes all sorts of abilities to see, you know, the limitations that are placed upon you. And I think that is, in some senses, it is a very contemporary issue for women at the moment, today, because, you know, that they are, in some ways, a kind of rights discourse is, you know, in danger of eclipsing a feminist discussion.
Yes.
I think it's perfectly right that women should think, you know, I should have a right to, you know, love who I want to, wear what I want to, and so on. But how do you know that the choice, the freedom that you are asserting your right to, is one that is, not buying into somebody else's agenda, be that a commercial capitalist agenda or a patriarchal agenda or whatever. So I think that is the deeply philosophical question that we're constantly coming back to.
Yes, I think that's very interesting. So the feminist discourse, of course, is not isolated from other kinds of discourse and discussions and agendas that are happening in our time. And we have to see it in that context.
Can I just quickly add? I think I'm quite impressed by certain things that one of my favourite philosophers, Iris Marion Young, who's died prematurely in 2006, said about really trying to transvalue the values that we have inherited in what she calls a commodified, efficiency-oriented, rationalist culture that we live in. And in this culture, sometimes, I think, the notion of choice and the notion of rights is misappropriated. More important than defending what we are able to do in terms of having a choice or having the right to do it, we really need to think about how our lives might improve, seemingly sometimes without necessarily making individual choices, because often the change happens structurally, and a lot of things have to change for women's lives in particular to become better. Yes. Not necessarily only initiated by the choice that individual women make. So I'm trying to sort of here downplay the notion of individual choice and right, which sometimes is a very big part of the liberal agenda, but I think needs to be questioned.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, Terry.
I think this goes back to what is feminism, and I think it was Vicky who said it's a choice or a commitment. And I think it has to be a choice in a liberal democracy, because we do make a distinction between the public and private spheres.
Yes.
And in the public sphere, it could be argued that we've already achieved many of the rights that we wanted to achieve, and we have legal equality. And yet we can say, well, in so many ways, women still face subordination. And so it's in the realm of choice that we can overcome that subordination, for example, in the family, where one can, if one chooses, be submissive, and even eroticize that or fetishize that. But the other choice is, of course, not to be submissive, or in how you raise your children, both your girls and your boys.
Yes.
So I think that's where, in a liberal democracy, the progress can still be made today.
Yes. And what would have to be in place for this to happen?
I think education and awareness, above all.
Yeah.
So that there is a genuine option available to women because they're aware of the options.
Yes. Good. Okay, that sounds very interesting. But in terms of who can be a feminist, well, is it really true that anybody can be a feminist? Don't you need to have sort of particular insight into what life is like from the perspective of a woman? Can a man ever do this? Is it possible? I mean, we have a great example, of course, of a philosopher who is a feminist, a very prominent philosopher, John Stuart Mill. Would we say that is the exception, or do you think on the whole this is possible and available to everybody, Terry?
No, you don't have to experience sexism itself to recognize that it's wrong, just like you don't have to experience slavery or racism to recognize that it's wrong.
I would put it slightly differently. In order to accept that men too can be feminists, I would say that men too experience sexism. That is not just women who are the victims of sexism. Everybody is. The same as when we talk about any prejudice. There aren't people who are free of that prejudice. Everyone, the receiver, the perpetrator, is a part of it. And so whilst we want to say that a man can be a feminist, I would have to stop the language which divides victims from perpetrators and say, in a sense, we are all victims, but you're also all perpetrators.
Yeah.
And therefore, it is possible to include everybody in any struggle that we want to launch against sexism or racism or any other prejudice.
So, gender roles in society affect everybody, so there are particular expectations associated with being a man and other expectations associated with being a woman.
I would just quickly add on Mill.
Yes.
No. Whilst Mill made a very passionate appeal for the vote for women in the subjection of women, in that particular writing, he did still appeal to certain ideas which were anti-women, as in appealing to men that if you were to give the right to women, it's really not going to make very much of a difference, because women will not exercise their position, their ability to use that right in the same way as men would. So he was trying to pacify the men, a clever move, at the same time as he was championing women's rights. And as I would tell my students often, remember that John Stuart Mill got to that point because of Harriet Taylor.
Indeed.
So while
we forget Harriet Taylor.
Well, yeah, we shouldn't forget Harriet Taylor.
No, that's absolutely definitely right. And perhaps this view that that you talked about, that John Stuart Mill might have expressed, comes also a little bit from his father, James Mill, who was not at all in favour of giving women the vote, and who said, well, actually, it's not going to make a great difference, because if you give women the vote, the overall outcome is going to be the same, because women are going to have a vote like their fathers or their husbands, so it's really all going to be the same. So it's unnecessary. Of course, you know, that at the same time, this is very insulting. Didn't particularly bother him. Terry?
I would accept that men can be victims of sexism insofar as they have to live by the gender roles that they themselves have constructed. But they do have a much bigger role in constructing those gender roles in our society, and I think that needs to be pointed out.
Yeah.
And also, many of the men who are victims of sexist gender roles are gay men, because those are heterosexist gender roles which are being perpetuated through culture.
Yeah. Thank you for that. We're going to take a short break and we're going to play some music. Terry has chosen some music for us. What's our next track, Terry?
This is Alicia Keys, A Woman's Worth.
This is Philosophy Now Radio. I'm Anja Steinbauer and I'm joined by Anne Brisby, Vicky Bell, Mina Danda and Terry Murray in our discussion of feminist philosophy. Well, the first part of our discussion, I think, has shown that feminism isn't one thing, but feminism can mean a number of concerns. It's a term that that implies a pluralism, and I think most feminists really value this kind of pluralism as well, a number of different approaches, a number of different issues that people wish to discuss under this heading. Now, I think we should talk a little bit more about feminist philosophy, feminist theory, and I'd be very interested to hear how it comes into your work, what it means to you. Vicky, would you like to start us off?
Sure. I think if I can go back as far as writing my my doctoral thesis, I think at that time we had a lot of feminist theory around issues that were just coming into the academy, around issues of sexual abuse, for example, sexual abuse of children. Mm-hmm. A lot of feminist and radical feminist analysis of those that were seen as somehow less philosophical, if you like, less academic than some other work, which I saw as very closely related. And I'm thinking here in particular of the work of Michel Foucault in the history of sexuality. Mm-hmm. And the enormous, you can't understate the impact of that work on the study of sexuality. So the first way in which feminism came into my work was in trying to see the connections between radical feminist analysis and a more Foucauldian approach to discourses of sexuality through history and so on.
That sounds very interesting. So I mean, can you say a little bit more what this means? Not everybody may be quite familiar with Foucault kind of analysis. How does this work out?
Sure.
What are the interests?
Sure. Well, Foucault's thesis was that power relations surround sexuality in ways that are kind of more intimate, that get into the bodies and forms of embodiment, than we tend to assume. That if we're going to study the history of sexuality, we need to be studying those discourses not just within legal state institutions, but also in if you like, the social spheres.
Yes, that sounds good. And Mina, is that an interest that you share in terms of the idea of power relations? And
yes, Foucault is a part of what I touch upon when I teach feminist political philosophy. But I want to talk more generally about what feminist philosophy has meant for me.
Yes.
I've taught a course, Feminism in Philosophy, for several years until very recently, when due to the pressure of changes, we had to lop it off and distribute it in many different courses. That's a whole other matter. What I have tried to do over the years of teaching feminism in philosophy is, first of all, to point out a corrective. Feminist, offer feminist philosophy as a corrective. The canon we know is full of illustrious male philosophers, and women are often ignored in standard histories. So I've tried to include women philosophers as much as possible in the many different courses that we now teach. I've also tried to give examples of misogyny, which are prevalent in the works of well-regarded, very important male philosophers, some that we study more often than others. But just to give you an example, we do Aristotle quite a lot. And there's any number of quotations you can give from Aristotle which tell us the kind of view he had about women.
Yes.
For him, the life of a slave or a woman is merely functional. It serves the interest of free men and in allowing them to participate in active political or public life. And the household is an inferior sphere. And despite having speech, which distinguishes men from animals, wives and slaves are lesser humans. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that you forget about Aristotle. Some very important women philosophers have used Aristotle to very good, made very good use. So Martha Nussbaum is an example of someone who's quite inspired by Aristotle and uses, has developed with the Matthias and the capabilities approach, which in a broader spectrum helps us to understand how we might evaluate human lives and what makes human lives go better. So whilst one is pointing out at the misogyny of the in the thought of male philosophers, one is also trying to take a feminist view of it, as in, when you are approaching the thought of another person, pick what you can make good use of. And don't follow, as I try to, not follow the adversarial method in which you kill the person along with the thought. So you don't even take what is good in that person's thought. Okay, that would, in my view, be falling a trap to a male way of doing philosophy. So even whilst I would criticize Aristotle for some things, I do not think that I'm ready to dismiss Aristotle or any other philosopher for that matter. There are many, many interesting, important things that tell us.
Yes,
so I approach
sure.
it as a woman, as a feminist philosopher.
Yes, that makes sense. But I think this is a very interesting and you know, very sort of sore point for a lot of women philosophers. I mean, on the one hand, we admire these great philosophers of the past, such as Aristotle. It's very difficult not to be inspired by Aristotle. And at the same time, these great men seem to tell us, well, but look, you know, really you, as a woman, are inferior. So, for instance, Hegel, you know, the otherwise great philosopher Hegel, once said, women are capable of education, but they're not made for activities which demand a universal faculty, such as the more advanced sciences, philosophy, and certain forms of artistic production. Women regulate their actions not by the demands of universality, but by arbitrary inclinations and opinions. So that's pretty damning, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I could add to that Schopenhauer, who says that women are childish, frivolous, and short-sighted. In a word, they are big children all their life.
Yes.
I don't
and
mind.
That's really
I'd
classical.
Love to play like a child all my life.
That's a classical view, isn't it? That women are somehow like children, sort of immature men. So I mean, what are we going to do with this? I mean, you say that we shouldn't dismiss the philosophers of the past for that reason. A lot of philosophers, male philosophers, perhaps would say, "Oh well, you know, look, this is just because they lived in the past; they didn't know any better. We shouldn't worry about this at all." You know. Why even mention it? Does it matter? In what sense does it matter? Terry, do you think it matters?
Well, I certainly wouldn't object to criticizing those particular views within that philosopher's philosophy, but I don't think we have to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I agree with Mina on that, because, you know, we're talking about ideas and not necessarily people who hold them.
Yes.
We can just take their ideas for what they're worth.
However,
I think there's a whole history, not just in philosophy, but in art and literature and film and television,
indeed,
a whole cultural history of representing womanhood in a certain light. Mm-hmm. And philosophers have also fed into that, representing women as, you know, childlike or children. And I think that
tell us
we
more
can
about
address.
That, because that's your topic, isn't it? Representation.
Yes.
So, yeah, tell us more about that.
Well, I mean, I'm coming from a representation point of view. Film studies is my sort of area. And so I'm looking, like most feminists, at the distinction between sex and gender and how stereotypes of gender are perpetuated yes. through cultural myths and stories. And I was just reading today, this is quite a frightening statistic, 22% of kids' books feature male animal characters, while only half that number feature female animal characters. Uh-huh. And I think across the board in film as well, I mean, if you look at, this hasn't changed since I was a child, actually. In 2008, a study was conducted that showed 67% of speaking roles in the top 100 grossing movies featured men.
Yes.
So then you get these yes, ideas yes. circulating in the public sphere that women are more caring, more empathetic,
yes.
more nurturing. Well, why is that? It's because we've had an awful lot of practice
Indeed.
Sympathizing with male characters and identifying with them, because that yes. is who is offered for our identification and for our pleasure.
Yes, but this idea of actually, since you mentioned of being nurturing and caring, actually has been made very positive use of as well in feminist philosophy and feminist ethics in particular. There's, for instance, Carrie Gilligan and her idea of an ethics of care, not just Carrie Gilligan who holds this view, but of course there are others who also make this a topic. Then, of course, there is a maternal ethics, for instance, as well. And Anne, I think you're very interested in feminist ethics, aren't you? Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that feminist ethics, particularly feminist applied ethics, will look at topics that male philosophers have ignored. Mm. And feminist philosophers have sought to drag the field into the contemporary world. How far it succeeded, I'm not too sure.
Yes.
For instance, something like domestic violence, which affects one in four women over a lifetime, is something which hasn't been considered by men.
Yes, that's true. In terms of the variety of issues that are majorly important and under discussion in applied ethics, clearly there are some issues that are particularly interesting to women, such as abortion. That's a very big issue in applied
yeah.
ethics. But then there are others which really feminist philosophy needs to bring into the philosophical arena, and domestic violence would be one, perhaps also pornography
mm-hmm.
And prostitution. So to make them real issues within the moral discussion, I think that's a serious contribution that feminist ethics can make, Terry.
But I think there's a philosophical question about any kind of essentialism, you know, that says women are inherently more like this and men are inherently
yes.
more like that. You know, to what extent are these just socially taught constructions which we've then reified or naturalized?
Yes.
If I just think of an easy example. If I talk to my female sisters, my siblings, sorry. I meant to say my female siblings. That was a bit redundant. You know, I say, well, why are you raising your kids in these ways that are just indoctrinating them with complete stereotypes about yes. what's a boy and what's a girl? And they say, oh, well, Tara, you know, boys and girls really are just different by nature. And I say, okay, then why do you have to teach them with all these props?
Yes,
you know,
yes,
if it's
yes.
so natural,
yes.
you won't have to do this. You can just trust that yes. they'll grow up to be nice little straight kids
yes.
like you want them to.
Yes. And I think it's very yes. difficult to really bring up children in a neutral kind of way. But, I mean, these days, I think especially more than, I don't know, say 10 years ago, everything is either pink or blue, and, you know, toys are either for boys or for girls and the like. Mina?
Just to mention... a very interesting development in feminist philosophy of language,
yes.
which got linked to discussion of pornography.
Yes.
And I think it's, for me, that's the way that philosophy, feminist philosophy, can be very creatively done. And I have in mind Ray Langton, who made a criticism of pornography by using the idea of speech acts. Theory from J.L. Austin, basically arguing that pornography silences women. It has the effect of silencing women. So instead of going into the debate about whether pornography harms or doesn't, and going into the question of how whether there is a causal relationship between the consumption of pornography and the action that those who
yes.
consume pornography might engage in, without going into that causal question, it is making a different kind of argument that the existence of pornography has the effect, the perlocutionary effect, because pornography is like a speech act. And I think that's an example of feminist philosophy making a very credible intervention in a political debate about what's wrong with pornography by using the best resources available that philosophy in general can provide.
That's a very good example. I really like that. I would also like us to just very briefly consider areas where you wouldn't automatically think of the feminist perspective as being particularly relevant or distinctive. So we've talked about feminist ethics, we've talked a little bit about feminist philosophy of language and, you know, feminist political theory. What about in areas such as epistemology, so theory of knowledge, but also philosophy of science? There is a feminist philosophy of science. There is a feminist kind of epistemology as well. In what sense might feminism make a contribution to areas like that? Because you'd think, well, you know, knowledge is for everybody, right? It's the same for everybody. Is that so, do you think? And do you have any views on
well,
that?
Well, one of the things that we can consider in regard to epistemology is who counts as a knower.
Very good, yes.
And it can often be quite difficult for women to be accounted as knowers.
Hmm. Yes.
And thereby their genuine experience is not taken into account.
Yes. And Mina, did you want to add to that?
Yes, definitely. I think there's also, along with that, the further question of what counts as knowledge. Does knowledge necessarily have to be available in propositional forms, as in P is Q? Does it have to be in that form, or to what extent can we think of knowledge and transmission of knowledge in terms of practical knowledge, something that you learn by doing, and famous philosophers have made very good use of this distinction between knowing how and knowing that to bring into the picture the kind of knowledge that women have acquired through living their lives in the way they have. There's a wealth of knowledge that they have, but because it doesn't find its way into a textbook or a manual, it does not have the same status that a knowledge which can be put in informational terms has.
Yes.
So it's trying to get away from the idea of knowledge as information.
Yes.
In terms of more knowledge as your ability to conduct your life.
So it really requires us to rethink. Yes. Thank you very much. We're going to play some more music. Terry, what else do you have for us?
This is called Just Because I'm a Woman. It's by Dolly Parton.
This is Philosophy Now Radio. I'm Anja Steinbauer, and I'm joined by Anne Brisby, Vicky Bell, Mina Danda, and Terry Murray for our discussion of feminist philosophy. And I would like, in this last part of our show, ask you what is it like being a feminist philosopher? Sometimes, from the philosophical community, there is this sort of feedback that we get that perhaps feminist philosophy isn't serious philosophy. If you're feminist philosophy, it's all a bit soft, you know, so you're not really doing proper philosophy. It's perhaps not even rational. My own experience includes the opening ceremony of the World Congress in Philosophy that took place in 1998 in Boston, where the Chancellor of Boston University, John Silver, gave an address, and normally these opening addresses to conferences are very boring and everybody just tells you it's a great historical occasion. But he actually said, so welcome of all philosophers except for postmodern and feminist philosophers. And it was rather an aggressive attack that he launched against feminist thinkers in particular. And he said, well, this is all relativistic and really it's also not rational. So it's not real philosophy, but too bad you have to be here as well. So What is it like being a feminist thinker, Mina? What is it like teaching?
I can't stop. If I wasn't sitting on this show, I'd be burst out laughing, you know, listening to what you've just reported about the speech that was given. But seriously, being a feminist philosopher is, first of all, being a philosopher. Okay, so I am someone who tries to think and judge for myself. But what I do try to move towards is that this withdrawal from generally held beliefs, which is considered to be good and a mark of being a philosopher, shouldn't be done alone. why just by myself? Why not with other people? So one thing which I think is important as a feminist philosopher for me is that the process of thinking for myself is done with other people. I start from the beginning, it's done with other people. And I've tried to use that, bring that into the teaching of feminist philosophy.
Yes.
In my university. So, for example, for the last 8 years, in one particular module and now in two or three adopted by other people, I have an assessment called a jointly written dialogue. So instead of asking students to write an essay on a topic, I expect them to, in groups of three or four, to jointly produce a dialogue. Inspired by something like maybe the dialogues they read from Plato or from Socrates, but brought up to date. They can be about in modern settings. They don't have to be set in some past time. But the main idea being that the position that they discuss and debate develops between them. Mm. It is not the sole property of either A, B, or C. It's something that is jointly produced and on which, of course, there's a creative element too. It's not a report of a discussion. They can hone it towards something. So that's, I think, is important in that feminist values are incorporated in how we actually teach philosophy. And I think that applies not just to teaching feminist philosophy, but just teaching philosophy.
Yes. So feminist philosophy doesn't become this weird niche area, which is a sort of minority interest, but actually it just becomes part of philosophy.
Yes.
And in fact, since feminist philosophy is by its very nature critical, it makes it actually very good philosophy, doesn't it? What about some of the others? Terry, you actually have the pleasure, and very often I think it is a pleasure of teaching teenagers as well at the moment. So are they sort of receptive to feminist ideas?
Well, I teach mostly teenage boys because that's the demographic that tend to do film studies. And they grumble a little bit at the beginning. But my job is to try to get them interested in films where women are empowered and represented in a positive way. And what they learn as they start to understand the difference between sex and gender and they start to understand the whole concept of representation, they start to realize that men and their roles, you know, masculinity has also been represented and constructed.
Yes.
And so what I want to do is kind of enlighten them to that and that, qualities that they thought were just natural or reified, they now can see that these are made mostly by a male-dominated Hollywood film industry. Yeah. But one thing that is kind of frustrating in the classroom is that male pupils have louder voices than female pupils and often in discussions will attempt to or succeed in drowning them out in group discussions or so on.
Yes, and I mean, you are very much part of the feminism forum of Philosophy for All and you're one of the organizers. What's your experience of feminist discussions, within context of there also being men?
Well, it's interesting. It's true that some men are very supportive and very good, but some regrettably dominate the conversation and they have succeeded in spoiling debates from time to time.
So it does happen, but of course there have been also I think very good discussions in including men. Vicky, what about you? How does the feminist affair?
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were asking the question whether I think of myself as a feminist philosopher, and certainly think of myself as a feminist. I'm not sure about the philosopher bit, because I teach in a department of sociology, although I think what I teach is very philosophical. And I think it's been a real joy for me to incorporate feminist thinkers and feminist attitudes and critique into those courses. And, sociology is, by contrast, with what Terry was saying about your course, it's dominated by young women. And they are very receptive to feminism, I find, on the whole. And I think Goldsmiths is a very feminist space. We have a lot of women who are doing fantastic feminist work and analysis in lots of different departments.
That's very encouraging.
So maybe they're self-selected, but I think there's also a kind of openness to feminism in this generation that's coming through, and it's not a shock to them.
That's very hopeful. I can mean it.
I would just add to what the observation that Vicky made. I'm a member of the Society for Women in Philosophy and have been for many years as an office holder, treasurer first, and at the moment for some years as a member of the executive. One change that I have noticed over the years is that in the conferences that we organize, more and more men now want to present papers in the Society for Women in Philosophy conference. The last one, the panel that we organized at the joint session of Mind and Aristotelian Society in July in Sussex, there was a man who was, through the refereeing process, accepted to present a paper. So that, I think, is quite interesting, that there is a greater openness. I certainly experienced that in my classes. There's never been a resistance from male students to study feminist philosophy. Many of them sometimes at the end of it say they wish they'd been acquainted with it at the start of their course. They would have come to the whole course of doing philosophy in a different way if they had been so encouraged. But just quickly, I wanted to say that there are still obstacles in terms of the position of women in the profession of philosophy, and figures one can point out. So in, say, 2005, out of all the women professors, only 14% were women. All the male of the professors, only 14% were women.
So there are
progression issues there about why is it that women do not progress to become professors as easily as men do. But I think that it's there are victories as well, one could say. So the recent one, which I do want to share very quickly, is that for the current research excellence framework, the REF, due to the involvement of Society for Women in Philosophy, a provision has now been made that the number of submissions made by women could be lessened by one per maternity leave that they take in this period, and that's going to be applied to all panels.
That's very good. So there is definitely progress, and we do hope that more of you listeners perhaps may take an interest in feminist approaches to philosophy as well. Just briefly, so Mina, people should go online and look up the Society for Women in Philosophy.
Absolutely, there's a website, Society for Women in Philosophy. The next conference of the society is going to happen in London in Kingston, 18th and 19th of November. If you go on the website, you'll find information there.
Excellent.
It's on feminist epistemology.
Thank you very much. Anne, anything you want to give a plug?
Well, look at the website for PFA London. This is www.pfalondon.org.
That's for Philosophy for All. Vicky, no. Terry, anything you would like to...
I want to urge all listeners to read my book, which is called Feminist Film Studies, A Guide for Teachers.
That sounds very good. And, of course, you're very much invited to read Philosophy Now magazine, which also has and will have more contributions by feminist philosophers. But also there's a very big event coming up on the 18th of December, organized by Philosophy for All, because it is by Philosophy Now magazine, and invites Philosophy for All and all kinds of other societies within philosophy to take part. It is the 20th anniversary of Philosophy Now magazine. And so we're going to have a big day of philosophy, an all-day set of events, discussions and debates and lectures at Conway Hall in London, in near Holborn, on the 18th of December, starting at 11 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. So go to the Philosophy Now website, philosophynow.org, and you will find the details. Thank you all very much for being here, and thank you for you listeners at home.